Accession number 22658, Rule 5.
This is the third reel of a taped interview with Norden Digby in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 29th of the 8th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. And we're talking about the rifles being chained up around the poles.
Well, the other thing is, once that they're in the chain position, the owner of the rifle would then remove the bolt, and he had to theoretically carry it around all the time with him, so that if they did get away with the... and there were occasions when they did get away with a rifle or a number of rifles, they theoretically didn't have the bolt, but knowing the Arabs, that wouldn't be a worrying part. They'd soon get another one. But of course, and then there was always the trouble of who was in charge of the key to undo the lock. That used to cause a bit of trouble.
Who was in charge?
Well, somebody had been nominated, some reliable person. we were advised that, you know, if it was considered... Well, the Arabs weren't allowed in the area, but there was no fences or anything like that around. And if they were caught in there, you'd caution them or require them to stay where they were, because they may have some armaments on them which are probably stolen from somewhere or other. And if they didn't do that, and on the run you were told to fire the hit. So the general opinion was, how truthful, I'm not too sure, is that you intended to kill them, because if you wounded them, you'd be up for compensation. So that was the story. I do believe it was right, but it mightn't be. But that was the situation. What was the
feeling then? In relation to the Arabs and yourselves, Israelis?
Yeah. Well, there's always animosity between the two groups of people, and of course that was one of the reasons they had to have the British government had the Palestine police. Used to administer all the problems that associated between the two parties, and there was no messing around with as far as the action of the police were concerned. If they thought you were lying, well, they thumped you, and they had big long batons, so they didn't think twice about that. It didn't matter whether you were Israeli or a Jew or an Arab, if they disbelieved you, they'd thump him quick and slightly. So a bit like the American Shore Patrol, they'd ask questions afterwards. But we didn't have, you know, any animosity with them. You had to be careful with the Arabs, because if they wanted something and it was lying on the ground, it would be gone, or wasn't nailed down or bolted down. The Jewish people that had been there had been settled in the kibbutzes and that for quite some time, and we would visit them on occasions and things like that, and we'd be even invited into their homes at times, but they were always, you know, they didn't have too much money or anything of that nature, so they lived a pretty frugal life.
How did they see you in relation to what you were there to do?
Oh, well, I mean, they knew what was going on, and I mean, if, for example, you say, what part of the world do you come from? Well, that all depends on whether the Russians are belting up the Jews or somebody else was belting them up. They would tell you that's where they came from, because that's where they thought we'd all be sympathetic. They ran the picture shows and things like that, and anybody that was interested in classical music and things like that, there was all somewhere there that would satisfy those types. If you want to leave or anything like that, there were libraries, when you got into the main towns like Tel Aviv and those, it was a bit of an eye opener to us.
Tell us what those occasions were like then.
Well, it was first of all, it'd be an occasion for you to get leave. You used to get half day leaves, one day leaves. Not in the early days, you wouldn't get a week's leave or anything like that. But you might get 2 days leave in Jerusalem or one of those places, I mean, allowing for travel and things like that. But there wasn't much leave given in those early days. I mean, the X-Men and that would probably get the benefits of longer leaves. But there was theatres. I mean, local cinemas. It would have been built for the army purposes, but they were like in a big open area, and there'd be a theatre there, and you'd get leave to go to the films and things like that, and if you were near, if you moved out of camp, you'd have leave. So if you were lucky enough to leave, you might go to a village where you could, they had open air restaurant types of things, and there were lasses there for dancing, and if you're that way inclined. It was quite pleasant, and the climate was, in the period that we were there, was pretty good. But leave was scarce.
You had to have money to go on leave.
Oh, you had to have money. We had 5 bob days. I think I used to get 10 bob or something. And of course, if you're making allotments at home, well, you didn't have that much money. And then, of course, you had canteens in the camps, so. You had to be pretty careful with your money and things like that.
Were you sending money home?
Oh, later on I was. Later on.
Were you getting news from home at this time?
Oh, occasional letters and things like that.
How important was it for you to get letters from home?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I mean, in the early part of it. I mean, they weren't any in peril or anything like that. So it was just a matter of them writing to us about on the day, you know, what's happened today and how the relatives are and friends and things of that nature. But then, of course, in response to those would be our letters, which they were subject to to censorship and things like that. You couldn't, well, you might have a few code words or something like that. But
what might the code words be?
Oh, I wouldn't know. I never bothered about it. Because I only had my family. I didn't have any girlfriends or anything like that. As I said before, I moved out of that situation. But, you know, for husband and wife situations and children and people that were engagements and things like that. And then all of a sudden you get a letter to your girlfriend and said it was off sort of business. that didn't go down too well to some of them. Was it
perceived by the others that some were coping better with the situation?
Oh, I would think so. But I mean, there's so many varieties. You've got scallywags and people that are prim and proper and middle of the road sort of people and boozers and gamblers and thieves, murderers, all those sorts of things. So, I mean, you didn't know, but they were there. So it's you couldn't really generalise on it, but, you know, discipline was around the place. And the other thing was if anybody stole something, you know, within your group, they didn't go down too well.
I wanted to ask you what sorts of bonds were developing between the group in the tent, for instance.
They'd sort that sort of situation out. I mean, but if you had a prim and proper bloke and he was allocated to your tent, wouldn't you just have to give him his consideration? Because it's no use becoming unfriendly about it, because the day will come when you'll rely on him and he'll rely on you sort of business. So, I had situations like that, and we could talk about those later on. But
you talk about them now, if you like.
No, well, when we were in Syria, we had a fellow who had epileptic fits. And in fact, he'd been in the 6th Division and he had fits on there, so they boarded him out. And he came back under an assumed name, and he ended up in our unit. But, he'd have these fits every now and again, and he'd be frothing in the mouth and all that sort of business that he'd been through to Brook and that, and the ex-blokes didn't put him in sort of business. But when we were in Syria, the chaps in the tent that he was in, and he belonged to a gun crew. The gun crews had their own tent sort of business. He started to have fits and things like that. Well, they came to me about it, and I said, well, you know, when we get into action, to have a fellow like that, you've got to do your guard duties and things like that, and five men got to do it through the night, and if this fellow puts on a show sort of business, you've got a problem. You've got a bigger problem if you're in the middle of action and he does it. So we talked it over, and I said, well, you let me know when it happens again. And I spoke to the powers to be about it, and that was a bit of a problem, but it was decided that I'd talk to the doctor, the EMO, and so, which I did, and then he eventually, well, when it did happen, went down and told him what had happened, and then they called him in and checked him out, sort of business, and he was eventually boarded out again. But he was, you know, great old fellow, sort of business, but it wasn't, it couldn't, when I say it couldn't be done, it was unfair to a gun crew being one man short, and more so if it was in a time of seriousness and peril. So that was just one of those sort of things like that. But that was the only real one that I had a problem with. But
regardless of where the chaps came from, what their backgrounds were, they all had to get on in the tent.
Oh yeah, yep. Oh yeah.
How did you make sure that happened?
Oh, they used to sort those sort of things out themselves. I mean, if they belonged to a troop, well, that was that group, and they all had to sort any of their problems out. And some blokes, didn't smoke. Well, they either gave their cigarettes or traded their cigarettes for something else that somebody else didn't. Well, they had something that they didn't want or something like that, and beer or some things like that. Some blokes didn't drink, so their ration, he'd work out something about whether he shared it with all of them or with one person. But I mean, I'm just talking about one bottle a week or none at all, which was on numerous occasions.
When you did retire for the night, would you talk amongst yourselves at all? And if so, what sorts of things did you discuss?
Anything that may have upset anybody through the day, whether some of them gone off to the two-up or something the dice. But I mean, that was all illegal and things like that. And of course, the other point was when lights out went, you had to shut up, and then you're liable to there'd be a check to see who was missing. So you always had those sorts of things you had to contend with. But I mean, there were times when we were short of rations and things like that. Well, hunger would probably be a topic. But
did you ever talk about, sort of getting into fighting, that sort of thing?
The other things we would talk about is when we got out, how we'd go to our lunch times. We'd go to the local hostelry, or what. Golf club we're going to though we never played golf in our lives, and they're just clowning half the time. But particularly those that are in the city, he'd say, well, we'll be down the palace at 5 o'clock or something like that, and at lunchtime we'd be down there to have a drink. That was all pipe dreaming. And,
I'm interested to talk about the fact that up until this point you hadn't seen any action, and what was the general feeling in the air about what you were doing? Did you feel as though you were part of a war?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, it was such a large area of hostilities that, which we'll no doubt talk about later, the Japanese business, there was always that uncertainty around the place, Great Britain and that was on the back foot, but carrying on the battle, which of course wasn't until the Americans sort of came into the situation with their equipment and their manpower sort of business.
To what degree did you feel frustrated about your situation?
Well, I suppose if things went the worst, we were in another country, how the hell were we going to get home, or whether we'd ever get home again. Of course, that sort of cropped up when the Japs came in.
Well, that was to happen in December of 1941. What were the feelings then when you heard that?
Yeah, well, with that, you know, you immediately say the Americans were going to have to come in because they couldn't put up with that. So once you knew that the Americans were coming in, well, you knew that supplies and manpower and aircraft and all those sorts of things would be to the benefit of to the Allies and to us. And, when the Americans really got into high production and building up their forces and things like that, we noticed a difference then, and then our food started to improve, particularly in the Middle East and
how did it improve in the Middle East?
Well, when the Japs came in, and when the Prince of Wales and the Repulse were sunk, things looked pretty grim, and our clothing, our food, and our clothing and that deteriorated, and it was quite noticeable. I mean, one had to supplement the army rations himself sort of business because, after you'd had a meal sort of business, you were still hungry. If you had a canteen and if they had certain things, you'd be buying it. I mean, there were many a time I would buy a tin of pineapple and eat the whole damn lot myself. Because I was that sort of hungry, then as things occurred later on, particularly in the desert, when there was a lot of canned vegetables and things start to come in, which were American, tinned potatoes and things like that. With the supplies had been interrupted from home and from Europe or Great Britain, and the only way that they could get to us in the Middle East was through around South Africa, come up through that way. So it sort of was a bit of a drawn out affair. Plus the fact that the German submarines were built a hill out of everything. And then all the Jepson, their submarines were in Australia at the time. So,
what was the concern then? We're possibly going a little ahead of ourselves here, but what was the concern then when the Japanese started to threaten Australia in February of
42? 42, yeah. We did know, we did get the news and that from, we had radios and things like that, and then we had local newspapers printed by our own units and things like that. Well, that gave us a bit of information. Of course, then you had the local newspapers that were, if you're in Palestine and that, well, they were in, they'd be English papers on the Palestine Post, and it was the name of some of them, and then up in Syria there were papers apart from the regimental paper and things like that. So we were, you know, reasonably well kept up to what was happening in the areas. But apart from that, we wouldn't have got too much information. Of course, you have radio, you'd get a bit on that. You'd have to go down to the YMCA or something like that to listen to the radios and things. But there's always somebody that would be down, would go down, you know. Some of the older fellows would go down. Of course, the big trouble was that if someone got down there, he might embroider what came across in the news. And so that's where, you know, the furfies and that used to start off from.
I wanted to ask you earlier how the officers were seen in relation to your initial immediate commanding officers through to political leaders. Who were your immediate commanding officers at that stage?
Well, I'm still sort of round in the infantry training battalion, things like that. So you had the company commanders, and then you would probably have some of your own reinforcement officers that came with you. There's a bit of a bond with them, and it was, you know, only apart from what was in the news, if there's any, you know, anything that came through in the news on the political side of it, well, I mean, you picked that up through the.
How are they seen though, in respect to the job that they were doing? Did the men actually look up to the commanding officers that you had?
Oh well, down in the Palestine areas, they're fairly well respected because they were generally pretty. Reasonable sorts of fellows, because they had to train these chaps to get them back to their units and things like that. So, but you know, as far as, you know, political,
how was decisions. Churchill seen, for instance?
Oh, well, there's no problem. As far as we were concerned, because as far as I was concerned, I mean, rightly or wrongly, whatever he did, he was in command, and that's the only way he can be. You can't dilly-dally around.
What about Menzies and then Curtin in Australia?
Yeah, well, Menzies was another one that there's no beg your pardons about what he did. Once again, whether it's right or it's wrong. Then Curtin was you know, respected sort of business, because he was more of a bit more humane than the others. And of course then there was a big problem of who was really responsible for our welfare, whereas the New Zealanders they were under command of the British authorities.